right, can everybody take a seat, please, and silence your cell phones? We're going to go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. My name is Betty Campbell. I'm the Vice President of Operations Engineering at Pure Storage, and I'm going to be your MC for today. Pure Storage celebrates what each employee brings to the job, diversity in thought, work, and background, to create a unique environment where individuals thrive. Plus, we have cool colors. We really have cool colors, so that's important. It makes you happy, right? Pure is proud to be a partner for the Watermark Conference for Women and to support the development and advancement of amazing women such as yourselves. I'd like to thank all of you for participating in this afternoon's session, How Women Rise, Break Through the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, and Job. We have a great hour in store for you. It's a privilege to introduce our guest speaker, Sally Helgenson. Sally is a best-selling author, a speaker, a coach, and a consultant, and has been recognized as one of the top experts in women leadership for almost 30 years. Throughout her career, Sally has shared her insights and inspirations through a variety of best-selling books, described as classics, and some of the best works on leadership of all time. We are here today to talk about Sally's most recent book, How Women Rise, co-authored with coaching legend Marshall Goldsmith. Sally and Marshall collaborated to explore the specific habits most likely to get in women's way as we seek advancement and to offer powerful practices to help us realize our full potential. How Women Rise was released last year, and within 1 week of publication, it was number one in its field. Please put your hands together and offer a warm welcome to Sally Helgenson.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Betty, and thanks to the sponsors of this session. It's wonderful to be here. How many of you were in the panel we had this morning? Okay, so we've got quite a few. I'm glad to see that. I worked on this session so we wouldn't have that much overlap. You may hear one or two familiar lines that I use every time because they get a laugh, and that makes me feel good. But other than that, the material will be different. So I'm really happy that we have this opportunity to dig down a little bit more than we did this morning on some of the behaviors that are most likely to get in women's ways and hold them back as they seek to rise. You got that? Okay. My goal today is really to share some specific insights with you that you may find help you tone up your own leadership style, but they can also be useful to you in helping to be more effective and targeted mentors, supporters, allies, coaches, peer coaches, and leaders for other women, because the information can be valuable in this. So in order to do this, I'm going to do three things. I want to start by giving you a little bit of background on the book, How Women Rise. Then I am going to spend most of our time together, and I'll take questions at a couple different points instead of waiting till the end. But I'm going to dig down on three of the 12 behaviors in the book that get a lot of endorsement and I get a lot of questions about. So we'll be talking about those. And then I want to spend the last 15 minutes or so working with a template for changing behaviors that you identify that get in your way that has been very successful and popular. So I want to do an exercise here that will help you to remember that and maybe put it into effect in your own lives. So let me start with a little bit of background. For 30 years, as Betty said, I have been on a remarkable journey in women's leadership that started with the publication of the book, The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, first published in 1990, still in print, which I'm very proud to say was the first book that looked at what women had to contribute as leaders rather than how they needed to change and adapt which is basically what everything academic or popular in the 80s focused on. This book came very much out of my own experience. I've been working in corporate communications, and I knew from my own experience, I knew from the from what I witnessed every day, and from an understanding of myself as well, that women had a lot to offer, and the organizations I was working in, as good as they were, had absolutely no way of understanding what the value of that was. So I wanted to put women's voices as leaders out there in the world. And this ended up with a total career change and working in women's leadership for the last 30 years. I do view How Women Rise as the culmination of that work, even though it's quite different in the approach from what I've done in the past. Now, this book, as those of you who are in the session this morning know, was inspired by my colleague Marshall Goldsmith's big bestseller, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, which is about the behaviors that are most likely to get in the way of successful people. Marshall, as a coach, had a brilliant insight, and that was that he recognized that the same behaviors that were helpful to people early in their career could become a problem as they moved higher and into positions that called for different skills and had more authority and scope and influence. But it's hard to let go of behaviors that we feel have helped get us to where we are. So he wrote this book. I thought the insight was brilliant, but as mentioned this morning, the behaviors that came from his own coaching practice, which is about 85% male, weren't always that applicable for women. For example, the first behavior he focused on in the book was learn to apologize. Do y'all have a problem with that? You're sorry that I said that. I have started on the programs I'm doing finding women that I'm working with when they say the ninth time that they tell me they're sorry for something. So we don't usually have a problem learning to apologize. We need to stop apologizing, in fact, and learn how to do that. He also talked about, you know, stop talking all the time about how great you are. Again, not a major problem for most women. So I suggested to Marshall, as a long-term colleague, why don't we collaborate on a project where we take this template, but look at the behaviors that are most likely to get in women's ways so that we can help women make that transition that many are struggling with from getting to mid or mid-senior level to getting to the top. That has really been my goal. I want to emphasize 2 points. First of all, I don't view the behaviors in the book as women's behaviors. They're human behaviors. But they are the behaviors most likely to get in women's way as they seek to rise. The second thing that I want to mention is that I wanted to focus on habits and behaviors for women because they lie within our control. Ever since the book came out, sometimes people would come and say, why did you write a book about the internal barriers for women? Isn't that blaming women for not being, you know, for their own career frustrations? Why don't you look at the culture and structure of organizations? Don't you believe the culture and structure of organizations are where most of the impediments lie for women? Yes, in fact, that is what I believe. However, what I have recognized is that the most effective way of changing organizational structures and cultures is to get more women in leadership. That's what I've watched for the last 30 years. So to the extent to which I can provide any tools that help women better position themselves as leaders, I believe that that is the most effective way of addressing culture and structure. So that was the approach, and that was the motivation. This is very much in line with the work that I have been doing for 30 years to help women recognize, articulate, and act on their greatest strengths. So let me pull out 3 behaviors that get a lot of endorsement across levels And let's talk about them. And as I said, I'll take a little time for questions at a number of points when I'm talking, rather than saving it for the end. And we've got an exercise or two if we have time. I will tell you that I've never done what is billed as a workshop for 850 people. So in terms of the exercises, not sure how that's going to play out, but we'll give it a shot. The first of the behaviors, and this I find particularly true of women in technology firms and anything to do with technology, engineering, but also financial services as well. The first behavior that I want to talk about is overvaluing expertise. And that is expecting that by becoming more and more expert in your job and doing a better and better job, that you will be positioning yourself for the job that comes next and attracting the kind of notice you need in order to get there. Success in a career, success in a job really has three legs. One is the expertise, the skills you bring. The other is, oh my goodness, they said there was water. Oh, there is, good. So one is the expertise. One is the relationships you build and your, what we could call a network or your web. I like to call it your web of connections. And the other is the visibility you gain. And when you overinvest in expertise, you tend to underinvest in building relationships, and you certainly tend to underinvest in visibility. I hear women walking into a new position, and they will say, I am going to keep my head down for the first 6 months. I'm going to really learn and nail this job. And then I can look up and start building the relationships I need. I hear men and I hear extremely successful women walk into a new job. And the first question they ask is, who do I need to help me make this a success? There are reasons that women get over invested in expertise and developing their expertise. They may have felt at times as if their expertise or their right to be there was questioned. And so they want to make sure that they demonstrate that they have the skills. But when we do that, when we allow ourselves to take that path, we do, in fact, hold ourselves back because we underinvest in other areas that we should be focused on. I was doing a program about a month ago for a law firm in Atlanta, and we were talking about overvaluing expertise. And this woman came up to me at the end, and she said something I found very, very moving and a real cautionary tale. She said, you know, you're talking about this overinvesting, overvaluing expertise. She said, it's the first time I've really understood why I spent 14 years learning to write what my goal was, learning to write the best law brief in the world, she said, and it got me nowhere. And the reason I think that overvaluing expertise can be dangerous is that it can make us, when that expertise doesn't get us where we want to go, it can make us disengage, it can make us feel bitter. I often hear women say, I can't believe they gave that guy a job, the job that I wanted. I did a much better job. I had higher scores, et cetera, et cetera. I had higher performance review on that job. But that guy, I mean, it could be, you know, the old boys network. We don't know. But often that happens because that guy has invested in building relationships and especially invested in building visibility or recognition for what he's doing. So it's really important to think about how this may be affecting you. It does use up, overinvesting in expertise uses up bandwidth we could be using to do other things that will help get us where we want to go. The other thing, two more things. When you think about it, being fabulous at the job you have really just proves how qualified you are for the job you have. It doesn't necessarily indicate your fitness for the next job. And in fact, it can undermine it. The other thing is, by overinvesting in expertise, you run the risk of making yourself indispensable to your boss. I worked with a woman at a technology company up in Boston, and she said that her boss came to her. This was about a year and a half before I was working with her. She said her boss came to her and he said, you know, I was going to recommend you for this job. He said, but I realize I cannot afford to lose you. You do this job so well. I really need you. And she said she went away from that feeling wonderful. Oh, he likes me. He thinks I'm great and I'm doing a good job here. She said it took her about 6 months before she asked herself the question, does that mean I'm going to be here for the rest of my life? So she said what she did was the next time a job came up that she wanted, she walked into his office and she said, this is what she said, I will slip my wrists to get that job. And I need you to help me. Not help him, not help her slit a wrist, but help her get that job. And you know what he said? He said, of course I will. You've been fantastic. He didn't really recognize, because she was pouring so much of herself into the job she was doing, that in fact she wanted to and needed to for her own development and her own satisfaction and in order to reach her own full potential, she really did need to move on. She needed to move to something else. The other thing is that you can become so invested in trying to build up your skills in the job that you have that you never feel ready, in fact, to move on. Because you always think, and I hear this a lot from HR people and even search firms, well, no, I just need another 6 or 8 months in the job I have now because I really have some skills and things that I want to master. So you can keep yourself stuck with that over-focus on expertise, and it's quite common. The other behavior that I want to talk about, which we touched on this morning, but I think there's some valuable things that were left unsaid, is this behavior of building instead of leveraging relationships. Now, I puzzled for years about why, if women, and women are, I mean, it's one of the characteristics, going back to when I was writing The Female Advantage, when I was doing that research in the late 80s, one of the things that women really brought to the table was skill in building and nurturing relationships. So for years, I used to think, if women are so good at that, and if that has become increasingly important and valued in organizations, then why don't women benefit more from that capacity to build relationships? And as I dug down more, I realized it's because women are often reluctant to leverage the relationships they have. That is, to engage the people that they have a relationship or connection with. Engage those people in helping them to achieve objectives either in their job or their careers. And when I ask women about it, what I hear them say, you know, are you good at this? How is this for you? What I'll hear them say is, I don't want people to see me as a user. Or I want people to know that I really like and value them for themselves. And I understand that, and I share that bias for letting people know that I really value them as human beings. But we have to find a more powerful way to also be a resource for the people we know and invite them to be a resource for us. I've thought about this habit for many years. And just 2 or 3 weeks ago, a colleague in Canada sent me a big piece of research confirming what I had been thinking about for so long. It found it was in a scientific magazine, published a long, you know, piece of research that was done internationally. It said, why are women's networks less effective than men's? So it was really establishing that fact. And the authors concluded in the study that the reason women's networks tended to be less effective than men's is that women had what they put a moral inhibition against leveraging and using the people in their network to help them achieve things. So that does not serve us necessarily well. And to some extent, as I think about it and as I interview people and talk about it, one of the things that it seems to me is it's kind of taking yourself out of being a player. That is, someone who is good to know because of the strength you have, who can be helpful, and as a consequence is always also going to be somebody who's going to be engaging you to help them achieve what they want to achieve. So, you know, we need to find ways to do that that we're comfortable with. We need to think more about how can we engage the people that we know in helping us get what we want. Two pieces of research I've found that are very helpful in thinking about this. One is, I read this really interesting book called How to Get People to Do Things for You, kind of a really out there title. But what they found was that the two things that made people, first of all, what people respond to most is a very clear, simple request for help, rather than, oh, can you help me with this, but a very simple, clear, can you help me, can you introduce me to so-and-so because I need to X, or you seem very good at getting resources in order to do this, can you let me know, you know, is there something I should be doing or thinking about that would be helpful for me to engage those kind of resources, whatever that is, to be really clear in your quest. The other thing is this, and this is something I think that's really helpful for women to think about. The main thing that the authors found is that the reason people help other people is because it makes them feel good. It makes them feel good about themselves. It's not to get something. It's not to position themselves. It's because it makes them feel good to help other people. So what I ask women is, why would you deprive someone of the opportunity to feel good about themselves by helping you? It's a good thing to do. So we need to think about how we can be a little more intentional in building our alliances in order to help us get what we want. So right now, what I'd like to do, and I've done this a lot with groups of about 40 or 50 or even 70, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to invite you to engage in a very short exercise in which you will think about how you might do this. I want you each, when I say go, to turn to the person next to you, introduce yourself if you don't know them, so engaging them kind of as a peer coach, and then I want you to ask them three questions. What could you use help on right now in your job or career? What could you use help on? And then who might you engage to help you? Who would be a good person? And then to ask for help. And third, how might you ask this person for help? So what do you need help on in your job or career right now? Who can you think of that might be able to help you? And then how might you prepare your ask to them? And then you'll do that. You'll share that information, and then I'll clap my hands and see if I can possibly be heard against this enormous number of participants. And you'll switch, and you'll each ask the question of each other. And then we'll do a short debrief. But those are the three questions. And by the way, at the end, when somebody gives you, if somebody gives you some advice on it, just say thank you to them. So that's what you do. Go ahead. We're going to take about 7 minutes. All right. Yeah. Whoa, thank you. You want to come with me to my next gig next week? That'd be very helpful. I just wanted to do a brief. How many of you got anything out of this? Ah, that's not bad. I just want to do a quick debrief. If anybody had a big aha or a big insight or something they said, oh, I'm going to do this next week, would you just run up to that microphone and tell people what it was? Go for it. Thank you.
So I've been working on trying to figure out how to get better visibility in my job role. And I realized that I don't have any real mentors within my organization.
Yeah.
But I have a peer who's done a good job getting better visibility. So I'm going to call him on Monday and figure out, what did you do? Even just the little things of promoting yourself that helped you be successful.
That is fantastic. And in keeping, Emily, terrific. In keeping with that bit of research, I would advise you to be as specific as you can in when you start. You know, can you tell me, you did a great job at this. I've been noticing what a good job you did. I need to get better at it. Can you tell me the three most important things you did? And then you can engage him to some extent as a peer coach. Let him know. Say, hey, I tried this. This worked in that way. And then you'll develop that internal mentor in a very natural, organic kind of way that's much more effective than going up to somebody and saying, would you be my mentor? Much more effective. Very good. Anybody else have something? Yes.
Hello. So I'm Muslim, so I don't really drink alcohol.
I can't hear you.
So I'm Muslim, so I don't really drink alcohol. So my situation is, like, how can I engage with clients or whoever, like work colleagues, like not work colleagues, but clients or somebody who I might need to sell to outside of work in comfortable settings, which can often be a bar or something. So I don't know how. If anyone has any tips.
Well, I'll start with a tip because I'm not
a
Muslim.
I don't want to learn how to play golf either, by the way. Like, I do not care. Like,
I'm not
I'd rather
a Muslim.
Read a book.
I'm not a Muslim, and I don't drink alcohol. And I have never once in my life had an issue where I walk in and sit down with a group of people and they're drinking wine and I say, I'm going to have a sparkling water. I've never had any kind of issue with it at all. Stand up. Can people hear you? Here, just grab this. Oh, it's not live, no.
It's okay.
Okay.
I do drink alcohol, I'll put that out there, but I have had times where I haven't wanted to, and I've worked in fields like entertainment and advertising where it's constantly kind of a thing. And my mom taught me a trick, which is basically, you ask them what they want or whatever, and you go to the bar and you get yourself, like you said, a sparkling water with a lime in it, and nobody ever knows if it's not alcohol.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. They're not sniffing your drink. Okay. Great. Now, okay, we'll take one more. But you got to use a big voice.
So I don't drink alcohol either. So keyword, Shirley Temple or Roy Rogers.
Thank you. Okay, for you. I can't hear you. Nobody says anything. Okay. Thank you, everybody. I've never conducted a seminar on this topic of drinking alcohol, but there's always a first time when you're in this business. And it actually kind of leads us into the third behavior I want to discuss, because I do want to make sure we have time to get to this template for change. And that third behavior, which is so common, we call the disease to please. The desire to be seen as wonderful and accommodating and empathic and loyal by everyone, and a discomfort when we're not perceived in that way. This behavior is one of the classic what got you here won't get you here, won't get you there, will keep you here behaviors that women often exhibit more than men, although I've certainly had men have come up to me in conferences like this and say, I have the disease to please. I identify strongly with that. So as I said, it's a human trait. It's not a woman's trait, but it's often true with women, especially women who are in fields, helping professions, fields that encourage people to in a lot of parts of HR, fields that encourage you to be and reward you for being an empathic person, a great listener, somebody people, you know, who people really think is a wonderful person. And that is a very good thing, and that serves you extremely well throughout your career until you get to a position where you have real influence and authority, and part of your job is being able to hold people to account. Part of your job is being able to let people make mistakes and learn things on their own without helicoptering in to try to save them from mistakes that they may make. Part of your job is to establish and model having boundaries. Part of your job is very much being able to be completely comfortable saying no or saying, I'll give that a pass. That's why I'm relating it to this question about alcohol. Being able to say no, I'll give that a pass, not for me right now. Thank you for thinking of me, but this isn't going to work, whatever that is. Because as you move higher, if you have that unhealed or untreated disease to please, you will run yourself ragged and you will do no favors for the people who work for you, because many of them won't get a chance to really grow into their own potential because you will be so concerned with protecting and to some degree even going so far as to coddle them. So that those kinds of behaviors are a manifestation of the desire, the need to be seen as a wonderful person in all circumstances and always be liked and seen as a supportive, empathic, terrific person. Now, one of the issues, like perfection, see, I really didn't think about this when I was writing the book, but since it came out and working with people, what I've really seen is that the disease to please and perfectionism, which we did talk about in the earlier session, are the two behaviors that are most toxic and problematic at more senior levels. And guess what? They also are the behaviors that are most likely also to manifest at home. So if you're a pleaser at work, you may also find yourself in the role of being a pleaser at home, someone who's constantly trying to make sure that everybody, even a 14-year-old, is satisfied and happy at every single possible moment, which most of us know is a fairly impossible task. So this is why you really want to think about if you identify in yourself with this disease to please, and you know you have it, if you're very concerned about what people might be saying about you, if you're very worried about if people might gossip about you, if you're trying to manage what people's impression is of you to assure that they'll think you're wonderful, then you've probably got this disease to please. And certainly, if you find yourself saying yes to too many things or taking on assignments that you know aren't really going to work for you or that you suspect aren't going to work for you and aren't going to serve what your greater interests are, then that's an indication of the disease to please. So it's something that you really, really want to think about and work with. So that said, what I want to do is I want to make sure that we have time to get to this template for changing, because one of the reasons I think that this How Women Rise is having such an impact is that it's not just a diagnostic, it's also has this really good, the last third of the book is really a template for change. So I want to share that, do a little exercise around it, and then we can take questions, because I feel you know, this is the perfect time for questions, but if we do that, I'm going to end up shortchanging this part of the program, which I really feel is very important. So what we have in the book is a four-stage, and this is something that Marshall has really developed through his many, many decades of coaching, a four-stage template for changing a behavior that you want to change. The first thing is to identify be very clear, start with one thing. Start with one behavior or one part of a behavior that you suspect either may be getting in your way now or may be problematic as you move forward to a higher place. if that's your aspiration. So you're not just looking for what's getting in your way now, but what might get in your way. So you want to identify one thing or one part of a thing. Sometimes women come up and say, you know, I identify with 8 of the behaviors in this book. I don't know where to start. Start with one thing, and guess what? Start with whatever is easiest. That's usually a good way to approach it. The second thing, and this is the most important thing, I think, in all the work we did, the second thing is to engage other people to help you change. Research shows that the people who make sustainable, long-term, positive behavioral change all have one thing in common, and that is they don't try to do it alone. They may have a coach, they may work with a peer coach, or they may use what we talk about in the book, which is a much more informal method of doing exactly, who is the, Emily? Is Emily there? Doing exactly what Emily was talking about, of, you know, engaging other people to help you. Say one of the behaviors in the book is, you know, too many words, too much background, too much information, as opposed to being really concise and crisp. Say you're working on that. So you can say to somebody, you know, we're going into a meeting, and you're going to be there, and I'm really working on trying to become more concise in my presentations. Could you watch and see what I'm doing? Help me understand, is there something I could be doing better? Where am I really coming off as concise? Can you give me that feedback afterwards? We're going to be in the meeting together. Or you could, like Emily, go to somebody and say, you know, I notice that you are really very concise when you make your presentations in meetings. Can you give me any tips on how you prepare in order to do that, that I could adapt? So you're constantly, to the extent that to which you are constantly and unselfconsciously engaging other people in your own leadership development, which is what it really is, by asking them to help you get better at behaviors, you're going to get more information, you're going to get more support, you're going to turn people very naturally into allies, and you are also going to advertise the fact that you are changing. Because many of us in an organization will get tagged as, oh, she never speaks up. Or, you know, I can't understand half what she's saying because she uses so many words. Or, you know, well, she's just terrible at self-promotion. She's a wonderful person, but not really good at self-promotion. She's uncomfortable with that. We get these reputations, and maybe we're not that person anymore. Maybe we've really changed. So how do people begin to perceive you're changing? You draw their attention to it by getting them engaged and telling them what you're doing. So it's really this kind of activity of constantly engaging people as a peer coach. And I want to practice that for a moment, but first I'm going to say the other two parts of this behavior. And then we'll practice and we'll do a quick debrief. The third part of making change is to really be able to let go of judgment of yourself and often of other people, because when we're hard on ourselves, we're hard on other people. And Marshall said that he has never worked with a woman, you know, Congressional Medal of Honor winner, senator, CEO, general in the US Army, where at some point he hasn't had to say, don't be too hard on yourself. Women are notoriously hard on ourselves, and that being hard on ourselves gets more and more costly as we move forward. So we really want to find a way to let go of judgment. For me, it was really helpful working with someone who, boy, does he not judge himself, Marshall, my partner on this book. I learned a lot by watching how easy it is for him to let things go. We were at his apartment one day, and we were working on the book, and his assistant called, which was very rare, you know, interrupting him. And I heard him take the call, and he said, oh, Dr. Kim, oh, I was supposed to call him at 2 o'clock. Oh, okay, all right, oh well, I screwed up. And he hung up, and I thought, I know who Dr. Kim is. He's the CEO of the World Bank. I'm trying to think how I would be feeling right now if I'd just blown off a call to the CEO of the World Bank. I would not be saying, oh, well. So I went home and I printed up on my printer in the biggest font I have, "Oh well." And I hung it on my door, and I swear to God, I'm going to get buttons that say "Oh well" in the color of the book. That's one of my intentions. So that learning to let go of ourselves, let go of the judgment we have on ourselves. And then finally, and this is part of that, remembering that this is a behavior that helped get you here. It's not a bad behavior. It's just something that helped you that may not serve you in the future. So with that, I want us to practice for about 3 minutes peer coaching on a behavior. I want each of you to select or think about one behavior that you believe, Emily's already done this, one behavior that you think would help you at this point, something that you need to work on. You wanted to work on your visibility. It could be working on being concise. It could be something that is not one of the behaviors in this book at all, but one thing you think that would be helpful for you to work on. Then I want you to turn to the person next to you, and I want you to say, oh, I'm on the wrong page. No wonder I can't see it. And I want you to say, here's what I'd like to work on. Do you have any suggestion for me? Here's what I'd like to work on. Do you have one suggestion for me? Anything I could do? Then listen to them, and then simply say thanks. Don't say, well, that's a good idea, but I couldn't do that because, or whatever. Because you want to get used to using this in a very effective way and objecting to what somebody tells you or giving them all the reasons why that's not going to work is not a really great way of enlisting peer coaches. And many of us have this kind of habit, this inner critic that does this. So that's the instruction. We're just going to take about 3 minutes. But turn to the person next to you. And say, you know, here's something that I think that I need to work on. Do you have one suggestion for me? And then thank you. And then turn it around, say it to the other person. This is what we call feed forward. Five. Yeah. All right. This peer coaching is working for you, huh? What? Oh, I thought you said something. We got two mics. Okay. I'm going to keep this on time there. She's giving me the hairy eye already. We've got two microphones, one here and one there. Anybody who wants to share what you came up with, here's somebody. I hope you're doing it. No, you were just standing up and getting comfortable. I'd like to have a couple people at the mics share anything you came up with that you found helpful, a suggestion you got. Rayona, here you are.
Sally. Yeah, so my great coach over here, one of the things I have a chronic problem with is being self-critical, you know, judgmental. I have some twins separated at birth in the room, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
And she invited me to start with a new practice of pausing to ask, what story am I telling myself about what's wrong with me or what's wrong that I'm that being so hard on myself?
Yeah.
I thought that was really good.
That's great.
The pause button.
Yay! Thank you. That's how it's supposed to work. Just an idea like that. Over here.
Something similar to that, I realized that I apologize and say sorry a lot, and I may not even mean that I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
But I say it to make the other person feel better.
Yeah.
And my peer told me to, like, stop and think before you say you're sorry. Why are you thinking that you have to say you're sorry when you're really not sorry?
You know, I heard a great piece of advice on that the other day. I was doing a program out in Reno, and there was a woman there from Tesla who was really sharp, and she was talking about how she'd made this commitment to stop apologizing with this very dramatic and horrible story with her boss, who really sounded borderline abusive. What a surprise. But it was really interesting because one of the women then said, well, you know, if you're not going to apologize at all, then what about if you go into a meeting late? You know, you're just going to walk in and sit down and not say anything? And she said, I don't apologize anymore at all. So when I walk into a meeting and I'm late, I just say, thank you all for waiting for me. Like it? That's news we can use. That's good. Take that pause and think of something else. You know, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. But it makes you much more powerful. You're not minimizing. You know, if you say it enough, it sounds like you're apologizing for your very existence.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
Along the lines of the apologies and the self-criticism, you can say thank you, or we were talking about finding, just holding a little bit of space, and instead of saying, I'm sorry, I can't do this, or I'm sorry, I can't jump in and solve your crisis, right, Hannah?
Change your life and be everything,
fix everything
you want
for
me
you.
To be.
I trust you understand.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be happy to help you, but I'm currently busy. I trust you understand. So trusting them to peer
nice.
You as
yeah.
opposed to
Beautiful.
Treat you like the person who needs to do all their work for them.
I love
so
that.
So I trust you understand.
I'm going to try that on my husband. See how it works. Was that the sound? I've got 5 minutes. Great. Okay. I want one or two other things that may have come up here. Yes, yes. You have to go to a mic, my dear. Just run around in front here and go over there. Okay, good. Sorry, she's sorry.
I hope you understand.
She hurried over and then said she was sorry. Okay.
My problem is that I don't read through an entire email before I respond and shoot it off, and I miss something at the bottom. And it usually, you know, whatever I send off is wrong, and you're doing so many things at once, you just want to get that email done and move on to the next one and yeah. go on. So my partner, Mona, came up with the idea of you don't interrupt somebody when they're giving you instruction when they're talking to you.
Yeah.
So treat the email like a conversation. Hmm. Don't interrupt their email. Wait till they say, okay, I'm done. I thought that was great.
Oh, very good. Very good. So it's, you know, you're kind of in this moment. We've heard it. One of the themes that we've heard here is a little bit of a pause. So not always being so responsive, but taking a pause. Yes.
This is along the lines of being self-critical. I guess many people also face the problem of doing 99% correct, but the 1% maybe not so well, and you focus on that 1%
oh, yeah.
and thinking about it over and over. But I guess the discussion just prepped me how you can focus on the things you've accomplished and ignore the negative voices in your head of you could have done better on that thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, keeping a list of the things that you've done is very helpful, because then when those negative voices come, you can look and say, well, okay, yeah, but look at this. This is the other side of the story. And also thinking a little bit about an 80-20 rule or a 90-10 rule. You know, as long on most things, you know, unless you're performing brain surgery, 90% is going to be pretty good. So once you can, you know, switch your mindset to that kind of acceptance, then it's going to be much more powerful. A friend of mine, Susan Brody, wrote a book. We were on a panel together recently, and it's called The Inner Critic. It's a wonderful book about, you know, the criticism we give of ourselves, and also how when we self-judge, we tend to be too judgmental of other people as well. So we're not serving ourselves, and we're not serving other people. So I believe that this little peer coaching kind of approach to dealing with behavioral tweaks, to recognizing that the behaviors that may not be serving us can be addressed by enlisting other people to help us, enlisting other people to offer us ideas, enlisting other people to watch what we're doing, and to, if we want, spread the word that we're really working on something, that's one of the most powerful things we can do. It also makes our lives, it just makes our lives a lot more fun, because it's a way of leveraging relationships, even casual relationships, in the service of our own improvement. And by the way, it then sends a signal to the people that we're engaging that we're also available for helping them. So I think it's an extremely useful kind of exercise to have in your back pocket, and a very healthy way of approaching, with less shame and less pain, the inevitable, you know, human flaws that every single one of us has, which women can tend to give themselves a very hard time about, worry about coming up to certain expectations all the time. So thank you. This has been so much fun to have an opportunity to do this with all these people. And I am heading off to the book signing, where I hope I can take some questions and talk with some of you. Thank you. Thank you very much.